This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Matthew Smith in for Julie Glenn. When it comes to keeping the water of Southwest Florida clean, how involved are you? In the second half of our show today, we'll talk with water experts who say the key to healthy waterways is starting small on the local ponds and man-made lakes that are ground zero for chemicals and other contaminants that enter our waterways. But first, it's called the Better Care Reconciliation Act, and it's the long-promised replacement for the Affordable Care Act, often called Obamacare, that Republican lawmakers have been promising for years. A Senate version of this healthcare overhaul was unveiled last week, and after talking of pushing for a vote as quickly as possible, lawmakers in Congress are now waiting until after their 4th of July holiday before they vote on the BCRA. Even if a vote is some ways off, the bill is now available for review and analysis from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office shows the BCRA proposes what could be profound changes to the country's healthcare system. The federal deficit would be trimmed by more than $700 billion. That's mostly through cuts to Medicaid, and the federal health coverage of 69 low-income Americans would be in jeopardy. That comes as the CBO estimate says that as many as 15 million Americans would lose their health care in the next year. That number would rise to 22 million. Continued policies of the bill through the next 10 years could see a total of 49 million Americans without insurance. Medicaid is just one portion of the BCRA. It would also change the monthly costs or premiums that Americans pay for health coverage. We have three guests joining us today to talk about the BCRA and what it could mean for the U.S. and for Florida. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Dr. Jack Hoadley, a Medicaid researcher and professor at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
I'm glad to be here.
On the phone with us from Tallahassee today is Andrew Berman, the president and CEO of the Florida Association of Community Health Centers. He's sharing his perspective on how the BCRA changes could affect safety net healthcare providers. Welcome, Mr. Berman, to Gulf Coast Live.
Afternoon, Matthew. Glad to be on board.
And also joining us on the phone today is Dr. Kelly Valancourt-Strobach, the Director of Government Relations at the National Association of School Psychologists. She'll talk to us about how changes to the healthcare could impact education. Welcome to the show, Dr. Valancourt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're talking about the Senate's proposed healthcare overhaul and what it could mean for Florida. We have our experts on the line who could answer your questions and help us understand the complexities of healthcare reform. Call in with your questions, 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can also reach out to us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And tweet at us on Twitter. We're at WGCU. And use the hashtag GCL to get your questions to us. Dr. Jack Hoadley in Georgetown, I want to start with you with a question about the big takeaways from this bill and how it would impact Medicaid over the next 10 years. There's also talk about states replacing Medicaid funds with block grants. So first, tell us, how do states today use Medicaid to pay for health care, and what changes do the BCRA propose when it comes to that Medicaid funding?
So today, Medicaid is used in every state in the country as a program to provide health insurance for people of lower incomes. That includes lots of children, it includes older folks, and includes people in the middle of the age spectrum. In Florida, there are 4.4 million people who get help from Medicaid, and that's one in five people in the state of Florida. This bill really will do some major changes to the program. And, you know, it's talked a lot about how it's a repeal and replace for Obamacare. But it really is, in the Medicaid program, something very different. It's really a fundamental restructuring of Medicaid. First of all, to take away the expanded part of Medicaid that was done in some states, although not in Florida, but then to put permanent caps on the program, and so that there would be a cap to the number of dollars that are flowing from Washington to Tallahassee and the other state capitals, and really puts a lot of pressure on the state legislatures to figure out how to continue serving the people who get Medicaid with a more limited amount of federal dollars coming in.
And we are going to dive into that question about what new responsibilities might come to state lawmakers in a moment. But first, I want to direct a question to Andrew Berman with the Association, Florida Association of Community Health Centers. The BCRA could see as many as 15 million Americans lose health insurance in just the next year alone. That number could jump to millions more in the next 10 years. So as somebody who represents health centers and serves people in Florida, can you tell us who comes through, who is seeking out health care at community health centers, and how is that health care paid for in Florida?
Well, thanks for the question, Matthew. We have individuals from all walks of life that seek services at community health centers. In Florida, last year we saw 1.4 million patients. Of that, almost 500,000 of them are uninsured, and another 600,000 are Medicaid patients. So we cover a majority of our patients in those two areas. So what's happened, though, over the last few years since the Affordable Care Act came into being is that our numbers have actually shifted from a very, very high uninsured rate to a much lower rate and a much more increased rate for regular coverage and insurance. But along with that, when people come into health centers to seek what their eligibility status was, we find out that many of them were also eligible for the state's Medicaid program as it stands right now. So the impact to community health centers in particular and the safety net in general is going to be pretty hard. If we go back to a higher rate of uninsured like before the ACA for FQHCs, that would mean a significant decrease in the ability to remain viable in some of our health centers, because about 35% of our revenues for the FQHCs are through the Medicaid program.
I think you just you may have just clarified that, but FQHC, we're talking federally qualified health centers, is that right?
Yes, federally qualified health centers. They're also known as community health centers.
Okay, so they are an apples to apples comparison there. We're not talking about two different things.
That is correct.
Okay, yeah. And please continue. I cut you off there.
No, that's okay. So what I'm saying is when you have about 35-40% of your revenue stream for like any other organization, all of our FQHCs are private, not-for-profit corporations. So, you know, that is a huge part of their operating revenue. So to lose what could be people dropping off the rolls and increasing the uninsured certainly will put a burden on the centers. It will also put a burden on the state, and that they're going to have to find ways of kind of making some of that up somehow, not just for FQHCs, but hospitals as well and other providers in the communities.
We are diving into a very complex topic here, and one issue I'd like to ask before we move on any further is the idea that you just mentioned, the combination of who makes up the people seeking care at an FQHC or a community health center. And you mentioned you saw an increase in the people who were insured after the passage of the Affordable Care Act. I want to ask you, did that idea of the individual mandate, the requirement for somebody to get health insurance or otherwise face penalties when tax time comes around, do you credit that with seeing the increase in the number of people who are insured, or was it something else?
Well, to be honest, we didn't hear a lot of concern about being forced into making decisions to take on health care. It was more of a, wow, I now have an opportunity to get health insurance for myself and my family that's affordable. All of the community health centers in Florida, all the FQHCs, have right now certified application counselors. Another word for them might be navigators at all of the health centers. So a lot of the patients that we had became eligible for the subsidized insurance plans through the exchange. And so that made a huge, huge difference for people, the opportunity that they could find health insurance with premiums that they could actually afford.
And we are going to get into what the BCRA proposal would mean for those individual exchanges, those state exchanges, I should say. But I want to turn a question now to Dr. Kelly Valancourt with the National Association of School Psychologists. You know, we are talking about changes that are, as we mentioned, really going to see significant changes that would impact Medicaid. But you were telling me as we prepared for our show that increasingly Medicaid dollars are going for services that are happening in our nation's schools. So I want to ask you, Dr. Valancourt, if you could break that down for us. How would a health care bill that touches on Medicaid impact schools?
So annually, school districts across the country receive approximately $4 billion in reimbursements for Medicaid for services that they provide to students with disabilities who have an IEP, which is an individualized education program that comes up as a result of the law of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So in Florida, on average, about 40% of all students in school districts in Florida are Medicaid eligible. Those students who are also disabled receive a lot of medically necessary services in schools that enable them to learn alongside their peers. And so these services include speech-language pathology or school nursing services, occupational therapy, physical therapy, mental and behavioral health services, basically a whole range of comprehensive health services that allow kids to learn and to benefit from their education. And then schools can then seek reimbursement from Medicaid to help them provide those services, not just to kids with disabilities, but to all students in the school. And so these Medicaid dollars really do help schools improve comprehensive health care coverage, which is critically important because we know for a lot of our low-income students, particularly in more rural areas of not just Florida but also across the country, schools are their primary access point to the healthcare system. And so we are very concerned that some of these cuts to Medicaid are going to directly impact schools' ability not only to meet special education mandates, because schools are required to provide a lot of these services to kids regardless of if they are Medicaid eligible or not. The Medicaid dollars just help schools provide more services and really help with tight budget times. But it is a way of ensuring that, you know, all Medicaid eligible kids and all students really get access to that critical health care that they need in order to be academically successful.
Dr. Valancourt, I think you may have mentioned a few a moment ago, but what are we talking about? What are some of these services that these schools in Florida and across the country are providing to students? Could you give us some examples?
For example, if you have a student with a mental or behavioral health disability, an emotional disability, that student might require some mental and behavioral health counseling by a school psychologist or a school social worker in order to help them, access the general curriculum, help them manage their behaviors in school. For students who have physical disabilities, students who might be in a wheelchair, they might need physical therapy or adaptive PE services to help them learn how to navigate the classroom and how to navigate the school building. Some students require speech and language pathology services to help them with their communication skills. There really is a wide range of health services that kids provide or that kids need that schools provide that are directly related to their learning.
Okay, we are talking about the healthcare overhaul making its way through the Senate, and we have a bevy of experts here to weigh in on what that change could mean in Medicaid dollars coming to Florida and other aspects of the healthcare system across the country. Call in with your questions or your comments. How do you think healthcare is working in America today? Call us at 877-428-8255. That's easy to remember. It's 877-GCU-TALK. I want to switch back to Dr. Jack Hoadley from Georgetown. The Kaiser Family Foundation put out some estimates about how much these premiums could change, how much these coverages could change. But part of their analysis, Jack, is, in your area of expertise is Medicaid, was the idea that a lot of people expect employers to provide health care coverage to their employees. And the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 59% of adults receiving Medicaid do not get that kind of employer-provided health care coverage. Why is that, Dr. Jack Hoadley from Georgetown? Why do we not see people getting that coverage through their employers?
So typically that means that a lot of the people that are working at lower paid jobs are in the kind of jobs that may not provide health insurance to their employees. So if you work for a big corporation or if you work for a government, you probably get health insurance as part of the benefits from your job. But if you work on a farm, if you work at a corner hardware store, or even some larger businesses that have made a decision not to provide health insurance, then that health insurance is simply not available to you through the job. And instead, under the Affordable Care Act, you either turn to the marketplaces, to the exchanges that make insurance available and provide subsidies to buy that insurance, or for those whose incomes are low enough, they may be able to turn to Medicaid for help, at least for their children, if not for themselves.
And Jack, thank you for that answer. I want to go to our calls now because we're getting quite a few calls, and you can join the conversation at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. First up, we have John, who's calling in with a story about his uncle. John, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. What would you like to share?
Thanks. So I just wanted to tell a story about my uncle when he was young and growing up in the 50s. My grandfather had an arrangement with a dentist and gave him $50 a month, and all five kids were taken care of. They could just come in and get anything they needed done on their teeth. And my question is any doctors doing that today, and will we ever see something like that ever happen? Because that seems to make sense to me, like more of a subscription-based service instead of going through these different parties.
All right. Well, thanks, John, for your call today. And I'll throw that question out to Dr. Jack Hanley with Georgetown. Is that something that we see in our current medical system?
So not really for the most part. I mean, we've gone to a system where health costs are a lot higher than they used to be back in the days when I was young. And it's really probably not possible to have that kind of arrangements for most folks. Although in some ways, what you get from a managed care plan is not all that different. You sign up for that managed care plan, and then through that managed care plan, you go to the doctor. Many of the preventive checkups that you get don't cost anything. If you have something that's more expensive, there may be a cost sharing to go along with it. And again, for those who are at lower incomes and eligible through the Medicaid program, they're normally able to go to various kinds of providers, such as the clinics that Andrew Berman was talking about, to not have any cost sharing, to be able to go get that care that they need and know that somebody is helping to pay for that care and they're not just asking for charity.
All right. Thank you for that answer, Dr. Hoadley. And my screen just flashed. We had a caller, Frank, who was calling with a question he had for Dr. Valancourt. Frank, we lost you. Feel free to call us back. We'd love to get your call on the air. But we're going to go now to another caller. We have Mary, who has a question about, I believe, single-payer systems. Mary, go ahead. You're on Gulf Coast Live.
Well, my comment is, and a question for the people on the panel, why isn't Medicare for All a single-payer system center stage in all of these discussions? Nobody really likes Obamacare, although it has helped a lot of people. People really dislike Trump Care. The obvious solution is Medicare for All, which would save 33 cents of every dollar spent on health care that goes to private insurers for their profit. It would allow us to cover everyone. And why it's not top of the list for discussion, I don't understand.
Well, thank you, Mary, for that call. And not to give all of our show over to Dr. Jack Hoadley with Georgetown, but Jack, that is a question in your wheelhouse as a Medicaid expert. What is the realities of instituting something like a universal healthcare system, as Mary called it, Medicaid for All?
Or Medicare for All. I mean, this is something that's had a lot of appeal, but over the last few years, the sense has been that the Congress has not been willing to vote for something in that direction. But in a lot of ways, the Medicaid program has begun to be sort of a stepping stone in the direction of Medicare or Medicaid for All. You know, we have some 50 million people, mostly seniors, that are on Medicare. We have some 70 million people across the country that are on Medicaid, and that really does provide a kind of care that's available to folks paid for through the government. And that's really the notion of what single-payer proposals are all about. And so if you sort of think of this as an incremental step, now what we're looking at in the new proposal in the Senate would really take us a step in the other direction. It would take the Medicaid program and put some significant caps on that program and mean that there would no longer be the level of resources to provide for some of the different kinds of services we've been talking about so far in this hour.
And, you know, Jack, it does seem like, is it as clear cut as, you know, a linear spectrum? Is it, you know, a universal healthcare system on the left and the BCRA on the right? And, you know, there's this back and forth tug of war between which direction, or is the system really more complicated than that?
The system is complicated. I mean, the challenge is, and you saw this during the Affordable Care Act debate, Obamacare debate 8 years ago, is people who have coverage through their employers tend to want to keep that. They don't want to see that disrupted, even if it turns out there's a more efficient system to have a higher level of government involvement. But people that are comfortable with what they have don't want to lose that. And so, you know, the whole notion of the Affordable Care Act was to try to leave the employer part of the coverage in place, leave Medicare in place, and then try to begin to build up alternate sources of coverage with government subsidies through the marketplaces to fill in some of the gaps and potentially to add some people to the Medicaid program who weren't eligible before. And so in a lot of ways, you can think of this as a series of stepping stones to try to not be so disruptive to what people like about what they have, but to try to find more opportunities for those who don't have what they need to have new options. And that's where the successes of Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid program have been.
We are answering your questions about the BCRA, the Senate health care plan to overhaul the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Call in with your questions, 877-428-8255. You can call us at 877-GCU-TALK. And speaking of marketplaces there, I want to have a question for Andrew with the Florida Association of Community Health Centers. Andrew, I think you might be the best person to ask this question to. One of the ideas in the current healthcare system, as Jack was just saying, is the idea of these exchanges, these marketplaces where someone can buy an individual health insurance plan. Tell us about what you're seeing in the BCRA that might impact how these marketplaces work, how these exchanges work, and also about some of the concerns people in Florida and other states might have when only one insurance company is on those exchanges.
Well, thank you. First, I'd like to address a little bit of what Dr. Holby was talking about, and I might be a little bit harder about this than others, but part of the problem is when you put up a single-payer system against the BCRA, you're putting up a health system against what I would consider a tax reconciliation bill. This bill has nothing really to do to change the landscape of improvement on health care. So I really have a problem with the discussion if we're going to talk about the things in like the marketplace, if you will. The exchanges is a good example. There's nothing in this that helps to prop up the opportunity for individuals to get health insurance through the exchange. If you take a look at the premiums that are being considered under the BCRA, again, it's an age bracketed issue, and the older you get, the more you pay. And the fact of the matter is, the older you get, you tend to earn after a certain point, you know, a flat amount. And so some of these things, for example, I find it hard to believe that somebody who's, you know, like they use the example, 58 years old with an income of $68,000 is going to be able to afford a $12,900 premium. So as much as we'd like to have the exchanges operate to the benefit of the individuals, if the tenets of the BCRA are installed, it really cuts down on the ability of people to get that. The second part of that, which is that you brought up.
If I could just ask Andrew real quick, just a point of clarification. So are you saying that the BCRA would make it more difficult for people to buy insurance on the marketplace exchanges, or it essentially doesn't really do much in that regard?
No, the premiums will be higher.
Okay. So it would be more expensive, essentially, you're saying?
Yes, more expensive. That's correct. The other part of that...
I was going to say, in fact,
Jack,
let
Andrew finish, and I'll come back to you. And then sure. I do have a question for you, Dr. Valancourt, so thank you for staying with us. Go ahead, Andrew.
Second part is that, yes, there is a problem with ending up with one insurer in any particular area. That certainly is not the point of what was tried to be done in the first place, where you've got competition, should keep the prices down. When you only have one player in there, you're kind of at the mercy of whatever their plans will work out to be. So, and again, that we're seeing already as a problem in Florida in the rural areas. That will be those people that live in rural communities in Florida will be devastated by this.
So that that increase in costs on marketplace plans would be disproportionately felt in rural areas of Florida, if that's what you're saying. Jack, I wanted you wanted to add on to what Andrew was saying there. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think Andrew is telling the right story there. The premiums that people are facing, particularly those age 45 and higher, will really go up substantially. But not only that, the premiums will provide less generous coverage. We're talking about plans that, you know, in the sort of technical speak of actuarial value, today the typical benchmark plan has a 70% actuarial value, or what's called a silver plan in the marketplace. This would lower the generosity of that plan to 58% actuarial value. And that means that it's much more likely that people will face very, very high deductibles. They might be seeing deductibles of $6,000 or $7,000 a year. So not only will they be paying a premium, but they're going to have to pay the first $6,000 or $7,000 of coverage before they start to get their benefits. And that's that just redoubles the problem that people are going to face.
Well, Jack, I want to ask you to kind of elaborate on that. Let's cut through some of those, I know, very technical-sounding words that we're using to describe something very complex, healthcare, of course. But one of the things that is being proposed under the BCRA is the idea that states would have the option of what some of these health benefits that under the Affordable Care Act were considered essential health benefits. States would then have the option to essentially get waivers to pick and choose what those plans they offer in their states would cover. Can you give me an example of what types of coverage we could see kind of fall away from common plans under the BCRA?
So if a state chooses to take one of these waivers to basically take away some of the existing requirements that were created under the Obamacare policies, the state could decide that what's defined as a full insurance policy might no longer include drug coverage. So you might get coverage for hospitals and doctor visits, but not for your drugs. Or they might decide to exclude maternity care, or they might decide to exclude treatment for behavioral health problems, substance abuse, depression, et cetera. And so people might get insurance, you know, still they would be able to say, I have insurance, but exactly some of the care that they need would not be available to them. Furthermore, one of the things that people have been very appreciative of under the Obamacare rules is that there's a maximum on out-of-pocket costs. There's a point at which you've spent all you're going to spend out-of-pocket, and then the insurance covers the rest. A state could opt not to honor those maximum out-of-pocket limits, or they could allow plans to put in a lifetime limit to say if your care over your lifetime reaches a certain level, your insurance is done. And those are rules that people really like, and those are rules that states could actually take away, all in the spirit of trying to say we're making insurance cheaper, but it's cheaper insurance that provides less value.
I see. And we are going to get to that question of how states will grapple with some of these decisions under the BCRA should those propositions move forward. But I want to swing another question again to Dr. Kelly Valancourt with the National Association of School Psychologists. You had mentioned earlier that schools could really feel some funding pain when it comes to what services are paid for under Medicaid currently. And when we were preparing for our show, you talked about some of the tough choices that schools would have to make if their mandates to provide services for some of their students were the same, but the amount of dollars that they would use to provide those services were to decrease. So what kind of decisions would school districts have to make when it comes to some of these Medicaid impacts when it comes to services in our schools? What would schools have to do?
So based on some survey data that that the American School Superintendents Association did with district leaders across the country. What we're hearing by and large is some of the toughest decisions would have to be is that they would have to cut personnel. In part, Medicaid dollars fund the salaries of a lot of the health care providers, such as school psychologists and school nurses, physical therapists, occupational therapists, basically people that are providing health care services in the schools. Medicaid dollars help pay their salaries. And with these loss of funds, we might see districts laying off large numbers of school staff, which, as somebody mentioned earlier, you know, the impacts of the BCRA are going to impact our rural communities the hardest. And it's in our rural communities where school districts tend to be the largest employers of that community. And so we're very concerned about seeing some of the ripple effects of job layoffs in schools because of some of these medical cuts, or Medicaid cuts. In addition, we might see schools offering fewer and fewer services, kind of maybe paring back to the quote-unquote old traditional model of education where they're just funding teachers and just funding textbooks and, you know, and reading and math and not providing those comprehensive services that include health, physical health and mental and behavioral health care that we know kids need in order to thrive and to be academically successful. And the biggest common area of cut that we have seen across the board would be to mental and behavioral health. So in addition to the possibility of marketplace insurance plans not having to provide mental and behavioral health supports if they seek a waiver to not provide those essential health benefits, we're also seeing very clear signs that schools and school systems would cut those mental health supports from their district budgets.
Well, thank you, Dr. Valancourt. We have time for perhaps a few more calls. We are talking about the health care overhaul making its way through the Senate. Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-428-8255, or GCU Talk if you prefer to punch in letters instead of numbers. And Dr. Jack Hoadley with Georgetown University, I want to ask you about some of those points that Dr. Valancourt just raised, how Medicaid dollars could ultimately be funding jobs and other positions in schools. We're talking about healthcare. I think it's an exercise in unintended consequences, really, when we think about the complexities of healthcare. But as somebody who studies Medicaid and Medicare, do you think these programs were designed to be paying for jobs in schools? And how would you respond to people who say those are the kinds of things that the federal government or our healthcare dollars shouldn't be paying for?
Well, I think that that Medicaid really is designed to provide services to people. But to provide services to people, you have to have other people to deliver those services, and that's where the jobs turn up. So it really is a direct hand-in-glove kind of fit here. And I think what Dr. Valancourt talked about in terms of some of the trade-offs and the pressures that her organizations would be facing really is what the state as a whole would be facing. So if you take a program like Medicaid, you know, Florida has run Medicaid in a very frugal manner, and that's a good thing in many ways. But under the rules that are being proposed in this legislation, that's going to hurt Florida. So they're going to set caps based on your current pattern of spending, which is lower in Florida than it is in almost every other state, and yet cap the increase in that spending at a rate that is lower than the growth that Florida is seeing. So lately, Florida's expenses to cover all the kinds of services we're talking about have been in the 5-7% range. But the index for growth in the Medicaid dollars being sent to the state would be set more in the 4% range for the first few years and then in the 2.5% range after that. And so you're really putting the entire state in a situation where they've got to make trade-offs. Do we cut out the drug coverage? Do we take some people off the program? Do we eliminate these services in the schools? Or do we try to keep all the funding on Medicaid but raise state taxes? Or do we keep the funding on Medicaid and cut dollars spent for roads or prisons or other kinds of services? And so it really sets up a real difficult choice for the state as a whole and for the legislatures who have to make a decision how to make do in what's already an efficient program, but somehow make do with even less money.
We are winding Matthew. Up in the one second, Andrew. We're going to take one more caller as we kind of come to the last few minutes of our show here. We're going to go to Mike, who's joining us with a question or a comment. Mike, go ahead. You're on Gulf Coast Live.
How you doing? Yeah, I just want to, I see this problem with the healthcare to be a two-sided problem. If you don't take care of the people that are more sick, then you're the bad guy. If you give it all away, then you're charging too much. But I don't understand, why is there a single tax that all the working age adults contribute to, let's call it a healthcare tax,
right,
and be part of a global, it's a social issue. My background, I was not born in the States, but I have experience in South America and in Europe. And we have to have more of a social understanding, and the education needs to be there.
Social understanding and a tax?
A more inclusive package.
Okay. Thanks very much, Mike, for your call, and I appreciate it. We are running up against time, so I'll just leave a final thought very briefly to Dr. Jack from Georgetown. Final thoughts as we wrap up here in our discussion about both Mike's comment on a single tax and the BCRA and what happens next with that bill.
I mean, I think the part of the comment that's probably the most relevant is the notion that we have a collective responsibility for healthcare. You know, some of us are better off, have more ability to provide for what we need and pay for the kind of care. Others do not. But we do have a single tax in a sense. It's our federal income tax and our federal wage taxes that are going to help to provide this system. And what we're talking about here is an attempt to, on the one hand, lower the taxes that are in this legislation and to do that in exchange for providing less money to provide the services for our collective responsibility. And that's what I think creates some real dilemmas for the system.
Right. And I have to apologize to our guests. I think as we were preparing for our show, we knew it would be a difficult struggle to try and get all we wanted to say in our short time. But I want to thank our guest, Dr. Jack Hoadley from Georgetown University School, McCourt School of Public Policy. Thanks for joining us. Also, Dr. Kelly Valancourt with the National Association of School Psychologists, and Andrew Berman, President and CEO of Florida's Association of Community Health Centers. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up for the second half of our show, a conversation with two local experts who say the key to conserving our waters in Southwest Florida starts with the man-made pond that might be right outside your window. I'm Matthew Smith, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.